The Destiny Foundation presents Rabbi Beryl Wein's Travels Through Jewish History. This, the 99th tape in the series, is entitled Judges 1, delivered in 1988. We hope you enjoy.
Tonight's lecture on the Shoftim is dedicated to the memory of Chanoch Henoch ben Arya Leib Fishman, who passed away on the 2nd of Adar Aleph in the year 5746. It is dedicated by Marty and Carol Ginsburg and their children. The death of Yoshua Binun, who was Moshe's successor, brought about a completely new situation in Jewish history and in Jewish life. For the first time, the Jewish people are an independent people, and they are in their own homeland, the land of Canaan, but they do not have a central strong leader any longer. I would say, without being too ambitious in the matter, that we could characterize the period of the Shoftim as a period that we can empathize with, that we can feel with ourselves regarding Jewish life, because it's chaotic, it's very diffuse, there's a great deal of almost civil war between the Jewish people. And the Jewish people are beset by a great number of outside enemies. And I think that the best way that we could term it in the vernacular sense is that the Jewish people found it very hard to get their act together. They found it very difficult to be able to put themselves together in a fashion to protect their interests, both spiritual and physical, and to guarantee their success in the country. This period of time, therefore, of the judges of the Shoftim is a period of great difficulty. It is historically probably one of the worst periods in Jewish history, but you can't use that word regarding Jewish history because they're almost, not that there are no good periods, but that they are very rare, few and far between. And because of that, therefore, to characterize all the dark periods, you have almost all of Jewish history would fit into that category. Moshe was the supreme leader. As I discussed with you, Yoshua was not only his successor, but Yoshua was part of Moshe. So here you had a supreme leader who was the religious leader and the temporal leader, the general, the warrior, the prime minister, the minister of finance, the chief rabbi, everything rolled into one. And the Jewish people responded to that type of leadership. But that type of leadership is very, very difficult to provide. You're talking about people not who come along once in 100 years, they come along once in thousands of years. And therefore, when they leave the scene, a tremendous vacuum occurs. In that vacuum, all sorts of things happen. Yoshua, before he died, was able to conquer 80 to 90% of the territory that the Jewish people would inhabit in the land of Canaan, and he was able to divide it among the tribes. When he died, he disbanded the great army that he had assembled. Each person went back to his own tribe, to his own family, to his own section of the country, and what happened was that the centrality of Jewish life, the center point, began to become diffused. It didn't focus in sharply. And instead of one Jewish people, you had 12 tribes that had a loose allegiance one to another. And everyone sought to do what was best for himself. The Tanakh itself describes it very clearly for us. Isha Yoshur Beinov Yase. Every man did what he thought was right in his own eyes. Right in his own eyes doesn't necessarily mean that everyone was a thief or everyone was immoral or everyone worshipped idols. That certainly was not true. What the Tanakh is trying to convey to us is that everybody looked out for number one. Everybody was interested for himself. There was no such thing as national interests, overriding Jewish interests. And therefore, all the tribes made local deals. And if one tribe was beset by troubles and war, there was no guarantee that any other tribe would come and help them. And that sad state of affairs continued within the Jewish people till the time of Shmuel, who is the last of the Shoftim, the last of the judges. I hope that this week's lecture and in next week's lecture will cover the entire period of the Shoftim, the 15 judges who existed in this period of time. And Shmuel was able to bring back the centrality of Jewish life as preparatory to the monarchy, to King Saul and then David and Shlomo, and reestablishing the Jewish people as a whole. But during the period of the Shoftim, the chaos sets in, the separation sets in, the arguments, the petty disputes, the small political things that always the Jewish people are expert in. I imagine that to put it in real terms so that we have some understanding, though I don't want to be misunderstood too badly, is that the time of the Shoftim was a coalition government, like the parliament that exists today in Israel. It's various factions, each one with their own self-interest, many times the self-interest overriding the national interest. And everybody's making a deal for themselves. And it's very hard to govern. It's very hard to do anything dramatic. It's very hard to take difficult decisions and to enforce difficult policies when you have such a diffuse 15, 16 parties to deal with, and everybody has their own interest. Well, I'm trying to point out to you that part of the optimism of the Jewish people is that we've been through it all once before, at least once before. And the mere fact that we've been through it and survived gives us hope for the future that no matter how we botch it up, somehow we'll get through again. But botch it up, we certainly will. That's also part of almost of Jewish tradition. The other factor that existed in the time of the Shoftim was the fact that the Mishkan, the great tabernacle that was built at the time of Moshe Rabbeinu and was portable, and the Jewish people carried it throughout their travels in the desert and carried it across the Jordan. This great tabernacle now was to serve as the central religious force in the country. But that depended who the Kohen Gadol was, who the high priest was. It also depended upon the location of the Mishkan, and it depended to what use the Mishkan was put. And as we will see, until the Mishkan finally arrives in Yerushalayim, it does not really achieve the goal of being the central place that would be able to unite the Jewish people. The Mishkan is in Nov and in Gibbon, and it's in Shiloh, where it was for the longest period of time. But the Mishkan did not have the influence over the people of Israel that it had during the time of Moshe and the time of Yoshua. Then the Mishkan was the physical manifestation of God's presence. The Jewish people came on a regular basis to the Mishkan. They saw it every day. They saw the pillar of cloud that hovered over it, that was representative, so to speak, of God's presence himself. and the entire influence of the priests and of the Levim were very strongly felt, was very strongly felt. But now, again, it was those that were near Shiloh, well, they saw it. But there were many, many people who never went to Shiloh, who never saw the Mishkan, who were not interested in seeing the Mishkan. There also was the question of bomos. Bomos were private, I don't want to be sacrilegious, private shtiblach, private little places that Jews had for themselves. Except that it wasn't only a prayer service, it was an altar where sacrifices were brought on the altar. And the halacha was that whenever there was a central place to bring sacrifices, then Jews were not allowed to bring it, to bring those sacrifices in their own private places. There was no heter habomos. There was no permission to have it. Because again, that would decentralize the entire religion. It would take away from the Kohanim. It would turn it into a free-for-all, which it did. It would prove divisive. And not only that, it would eventually contribute to idolatry, which also it did. But if the Mishkan was not established, if it was also only transient, then the bomos were permitted. So you had periods of time when the bomos were permitted, when Jews were allowed to have their own private, you know, in your backyard, instead of having lawn chairs and redwood decks, etc. So everybody had a boma. And there was a time when that was permitted. Well, when that was permitted, so even when it became forbidden, people didn't give it up. They kept it. And there were Kohanim, there were people who were interested in keeping it, because if you were the local priest, let's say, so you didn't want to go work at the central place in Shiloh, you had your own place in your own town. You had your own boma. And therefore, we find throughout Tanakh, during the entire period of the first Beis HaMikdash, it says over and over again, Rak HaBomos Lo Soru. The Bomos they were unable to get rid of. Even the great kings of Judah, who reformed the people in terms of bringing them close to Torah, and who stopped idolatry, and who were able to inculcate them with the spirit and ideas of Torah, they couldn't get rid of the bomos. The bomos were so ingrained within the Jewish people that short of sending police to every house in the country, there was no way of getting rid of them. And if you'll think about it, again, I'm not saying it negatively, it's just historically, the Jewish people have a tendency for that always. Where you could have one, we always want to have two. Everybody in Yiddish, there's a phrase, you know, machen Shabbos far sich. Everybody wants to make Shabbos for himself. It's going to be very hard, God willing, when the third temple is built, as it will be, and we'll all come and rejoice in it, so there'll be, you know, it's going to be very hard to adjust that I can't have my own nusach, or I can't do it my way, or, you know, I like it this way, right? I want them to start 7 in the morning, not 9. And the other guy's saying, oh, 9:30. The Beis HaMikdash is going to have to start on time. There's going to be one service for everybody. That's going to be very hard to get accustomed to. That's not the nature of the Jewish people. You have to realize the things that preserved us, that's one of the rules of Jewish history. Every mile is a chesaron. Every advantage is a disadvantage. The advantages of the Jewish people are that we can live without anybody else, and we can live by ourselves. And any 10 Jews can set up a synagogue, and so that's a great advantage. I mean, the Catholic Church can't get along without the Vatican. We don't need such things. The disadvantage is that any 10 Jews can set up a synagogue. My old bad joke that The Hungarians say that the best thing about marriage is that you're not alone, and the worst thing about marriage is that you're not alone. Well, that's the same truism here. The strength of the Jewish people always has a flip side to it, always has the coin on the opposite side. And the coin on the opposite side is that it also is the weakness of the Jewish people. And here in the time of the Tanakh, we'll see this played out over and over again. The Bomos are the prime example, but there are many, many other examples. In the time of the Shoftim, paganism existed among the Jewish people, just as Moshe warned them it would. Moshe said, I know before I die that when I die, a section of the Jewish people will fall to paganism. So our rabbis say that that didn't happen until Yeshua died. Because, as I explained to you, Yeshua was Moshe. So as long as Yeshua was alive, Moshe was alive. But when Yeshua died and the period of the Shoftim began, it is an easy step from the Bomos, from having a private altar in the backyard, so to speak, to Judaism, so you could have a private altar in the backyard for a more attractive religion, right? Oh, you know, my neighbors, they've got beautiful jade gods, this, that, you know, we'll try that too. And since the pagans were in the country, and since the pagans had an enormous influence, the neighboring countries and cultures had an enormous influence on the Jews, paganism, Avodah Zorah, was a fact of life during the time of the Shoftim. And that's a fifth column within the country. It's an entire element within the country that literally stands against what the Jewish people are trying to accomplish and what the Jewish national mission is. That exists today also. You know, you don't. There's sometimes people do things that drive you out of your mind. What Jews can do to themselves. But that also happened during the entire period of the Shoftim. And there was a greater anomaly. Rabbi Reuven Margolius mentions it in his books, and other scholars mention it, that the Jews at one and the same time were observant of ritual and worshipped Avodah Zorah at the same time. In other words, they were Sabbath observers, and they ate glatt kosher, and they put on tefillin in the morning, and they wore tzitzis, and they had a getchka in the backyard. And that's also a Jewish trait. Jews are able to do that. Jews are able to be very, very flexible when they want to be. And all of this together begins to give us a picture of the time where you don't have central temporal authority, you don't have a central government, you don't really have central religious authority. You're subject to pagan influences that are very strong. And on top of it, it is a period of continual warfare. Continual warfare. Not much different than the time that we live in. In fact, when I prepared this lecture, in the 40 seconds I usually allow for the preparation of a lecture, it has struck me over and over again how one, if one wishes to, could draw parallelisms. Every time the Jewish people come back to their country, the same problems exist. Outside enemies, internal enemies, an entire section of the Jewish people which is inimical to Jewish values, chaos, complete diffusion in the ranks, almost civil war, factionalism. All of these problems that you can, if you read the Tanakh, you're reading today's newspaper. The names change, but everything else is the same. You talk about the problems of the State of Israel, the problems of the State of Israel today are the problems that exist in the time of the Shoftim. Oh, again, as I mentioned before, on one hand, that's very encouraging because we survived the time of the Shoftim. We got to a better time. On the other hand, it's very depressing because of the fact that it took a few hundred years and a lot of blood and a lot of sacrifice, and not everybody made it, which is also part of the pattern of Jewish history, that large sections of the Jewish people fall away. This type of a process is a very expensive process. And the expense is always in people. People just fall away. So this picture of Jewish life now will be fleshed in by the events that occur. When Yehoshua died, so the Jewish people looked for leadership. Now, it's interesting, the Shoftim were not elected people. And they were not appointed people. They were like leaders that arose from the people by themselves, who automatically took on the responsibility of leadership, and who were recognized by the people as being special. According to many, the Shoftim had to have the imprimatur of the prophets who lived at the time. According to others, not the prophets, but that it was the Sanhedrin that agreed as to who was the Shofet. But there are opinions, valid opinions among the rabbis, that nobody agreed. And that the Shofet was a, to a certain extent, a self-made leader who undertook on his own to be the leader of the people and was accepted as the leader of the people. You don't even have a council or a parliament. You don't have a group of people that meet together. And therefore, the Shoftim had, to a certain extent, minimal influence on the Jewish people generally. And their strongest influence was in matters of defense of the country. In fact, if it would not have been for the constant wars, as I have mentioned to you, the constant wars that prevailed against the Jewish people, the Jewish people probably could have said that they could have done very well without the Shoftim also. The Jewish people are the most anti-government people in the history of the world. We don't respond well to governing or to being governed. It's a cantankerous, stubborn, independent, nonconformist people, and it's very hard to govern. I always mention Weizmann's joke to Truman, that Weizmann told Truman that the difference between you, Mr. President, and I, who am also the president, he said, you're the president over 150 million citizens, and I'm the president over 2.5 million presidents. There's a great deal of truth to that. And it's because, it's the nature of the Jewish people that makes it that way. When I was in Jerusalem this summer, this last summer, so I took my wife out for her once in 20 year visit to a restaurant, and then when it was over, so across the street there was a little shul, and they were about to daven Maariv. The gabbai was standing out on the street, you know, announcing Maariv, anybody wants to daven Maariv? So I said, you know, Jackie, wait here, and I'm going to go daven Maariv. Just then a car pulls up, and the car stops, double parks. The street is little as Yoel Solomon Street. It's about as big as my driveway, as wide as the driveway. And he double parks in the middle, and the guy runs out. He's going to go daven Maariv double parked. So he does it right in front of a police captain who's standing there. So the police captain calls him over and starts giving it to him left and right, and he wants his driver's license. He's going to write him out the ticket. In the middle, the gabbai's hollering Maariv. So the captain and the guy go in together. They daven Maariv together. And then he comes out, and they start all over again, right? And then the captain starts all over again, and the guy's giving it back to him. You know, he said, you see, we have the Dom Mayim. So that's a vignette of the Jewish people. We are not accustomed, you know, that the traffic policeman's going to be the 10th one to the minion, right? And so he loses something thereby. He gains a great deal thereby, but he loses something thereby also. Because he's no better than you are. He can't daven Maariv without you. So within the Jewish people who are so democratic and so cantankerous, there is an element that doesn't allow for easy governing. And the period of the Shoftim is the great example of that problem as it played out over hundreds of years. This is not a one-time event. It's not that after 20 years they learn to behave themselves. That doesn't happen. This thing takes hundreds and hundreds of years until the time of Shmuel and until the time of Shaul and David, and the entire unity of the Jewish people lasts a very short period of time. It lasts less than a century, and then the country splits up again. That's just our nature. The first of the Shoftim was a man called Othniel ben Kenaz. Othniel ben Kenaz, so many say he is related to Kaleb ben Yefune. He was from the tribe of Yehuda, and he was not a Talmud, a disciple so much of Joshua, as he was a colleague of Joshua. And he lived longer. In fact, he was the Shofet for 40 years. His reign was longer than that of Joshua. For 40 years, he was the Shofet. He was a great Talmud Chochem, a great Jewish scholar. Our rabbis tell us that during the time when Moshe Rabbeinu died, so the Jewish people observed a 30-day period of mourning for him. And the 30-day period of mourning was so intense that they did not pursue their Torah studies with the usual vigor in the academies of learning. And so during that 30-day period of time, a great many halachas, because it was all Torah Shebaal Peh, it was all the oral law, a great many halachas were lost. They were forgotten. They, you know, if you don't learn for 30 days, you don't remember. The rule is even better. The Talmud tells us that if you forsake the Torah for one day, it will forsake you for two. So if you're away for 30 days, so then the Torah is away for 60 days. And that's hard to make up. So when the Jewish people came back to learn, they forgot. According to one opinion, they had forgotten thousands of halachas. According to another opinion, hundreds of halachas. So Yoshua went to God, he appealed to heaven, and he said, you know, we forgot all of this, and we don't have a book, and nobody has the video for Moshe to play over. They had the video, they didn't have the VCR. Moshe was beta. So they didn't know what to do. So God told them, I'm sorry, you know, we only give the Torah once from heaven. That's it. Forgotten is forgotten. Lost is lost. We only give it once. So it says, Acher Ziron Othniel ben Kenaz Pilpulo. Othniel ben Kenaz, through his powers of reasoning, was able to reconstruct all the lost halachas. In other words, there was enough of a parameter of Torah that remained that within the parameter and the given axioms, you were able, if you applied yourself, great scholars were able to reconstruct it. And that has been the method of Torah ever since. Some of the greatest works of Jewish scholarship have been lost and they've been reconstructed in a different generation by others. Simply because the principles are there. So that was Othniel ben Kenaz. He was not just, but he was not just a general or a leader. Othniel ben Kenaz was the leading Torah scholar of his day. He was the man that restored a portion of the Torah that otherwise would have been lost from the Jewish people completely. And he was the shofet for 40 years. Most of the scholars say that he became the shofet in the year 1244 before the Common Era. And that he therefore reigned until the year 1204 before the Common Era. In the Jewish date, it was to the year 2516 to creation that he became the leader of the Jewish people. And he fought a great battle, a great war. There was a Canaanite warrior called Kushan Rishasayim. Rishasayim literally means he was a double Russia. I mean, he was like Russia squared. Tremendously evil tyrant. And the leading power in the area then was the Phoenician Empire. And the Phoenicians were Canaanites. And they were a little like Saudi Arabia is today. They never went to war. They financed all of these guys. These guys were the PLO. They kept on giving them the money. They financed them. They supplied them. They saw that it kept on going. And Kushan Rishasayim was the leading warrior, the leading sheikh, the chief of the clan that made war against the Jewish people. And he laid waste thousands of acres of Jewish land. He killed hundreds and hundreds of Jews. And not only that, he took away the security that Jews felt in their homeland. Security is not always an actual thing as much as it's a psychological thing. A person that feels safe, so he is safe. And a person that feels threatened, and he feels that he can't walk on the street, or that he can't drive through a certain neighborhood, or he can't walk at night, so then he is threatened. And Kushan Rishasayim restored the threat to the Jewish people. He undermined their sense of security, which Yehoshua had built up so painstakingly over the years. And he also was abetted by the fact that there was a section of the Jewish people, as I mentioned, that were idol worshippers, that were pagans, who adopted the culture and the civilization of the Phoenicians, who wanted to imitate them. We find today in all the archaeological digs of that time, you find there are hundreds and hundreds of little house gods, they're called, trophim, the little gods that people had in their house. And so the wealthy people had them made out of gold and out of jade and out of precious stone. The poor people had them out of wood and out of stone, out of metal. But everybody had, the little getchka in the house. And that was part of the culture. It's like today, you can't, it's like a piece of furniture in the house. How can you have a house without a bakefront? Right? You're not Jewish. You have a house without a chandelier. I remember, I always say that all the stories that I tell are true, it's just that some of them haven't occurred as of yet. But I remember that once, God should protect me, but once I was mugged by a disadvantaged person in the city of New York, who relieved me of my wallet and my watch and a few other things, and who frightened the life out of me at knife point. So when I went to the police and reported the whole thing, and the man was eventually caught, identified, and released, so that he could do it again. So I was spent 4 or 5 hours in the police station. So one of the policemen there, who was on duty that night, said to me, he said that he had been assigned to the Borough Park precinct for about a year and a half. And he said he learned a lot about the Jewish people, but he said nobody ever explained to him why in the Jewish religion one must have a chandelier. And he was not joking. He said every home had a chandelier. He said he couldn't, no one ever gave him a good reason why. Well, what to us is the chandelier in the time of the Shoftim were the getchkas that they had in the house. You had to have one. Otherwise, how could you be without one? And I imagine the Lord can tolerate chandeliers, but he is not willing to tolerate the idols. So Kushan Rishasayim is not an accident. Kushan Rishasayim is God's response to Jewish behavior. Just as unfortunately we see certain responses to Jewish behavior today as well. All of that together gives us a picture of the difficulties that Othniel ben Knaz faced. But he was able to defeat Kushan Rishathaim. He was able to put the country back in a secure and strong and vital position. But he was not able to establish a centrality of power in Jewish life. And he was not able to see that the Bomos should be removed. And when he died after being the Shofet for 40 years, the situation was not much better than it was than when he began. Even though he had accomplished a great deal simply by salvaging the Jewish state, salvaging the Jewish people, because after the death of Yeshua, it could have fallen apart in a very, very short period of time, physically, religiously, socially, in every way possible. New enemies come on the Jewish people. The new enemies are not from the north anymore, the Canaanites and the Phoenicians, who were pretty much subdued. There are two new enemies on the scene. One is from the south and the west, the Philistines, the Plishtim. The Plishtim were an Aryan race who came originally from the Greek islands, from Crete and from Cyprus, and who settled along the coast. The Gaza Strip has never been a quiet place for us. It's interesting. All the trouble spots remain the same. And the others were east of the Jordan, Moab and Ammon. The children of Lot, our distant cousins, who had been subdued by Moshe and then later by Yoshua, now all of a sudden revived after hundreds of years. And they revived with ancient claims, right? Like every Palestinian owned the house in Jaffa that we took from them. That they came and they said, 200 years ago, this was my father's farm and now the Jews are there. We want it back. So the Jewish state was fighting a two-front war. One on the western front against the Philistines, who made very strong inroads almost to Yerushalayim from the Gaza Strip. And the second was from the eastern side of the Jordan River, where there were 2.5 Jewish tribes east of the Jordan, but south of where the Jews were and east of where the Jews were the tribes of Moab and Ammon, who were very fierce and warlike and who refused, and they would refuse for hundreds of years to make peace with the situation that the Jews had a right to be there. So the next of the Shoftim was a man called Ehud ben Gera. Ehud ben Gera is known in the Tanakh because he was a lefty. Jews, traditional Jewish mothers don't like left-handed children. Whether that's Jewish, I haven't been able to determine whether that's a Jewish custom or just an Eastern European custom, even among others. But, I knew friends of mine who were left-handed who taught themselves to eat right-handed and to write right-handed. So in school they would write left-handed, but when their mother saw them doing the homework, they would write right-handed because otherwise she would have a fit. So they literally taught themselves to be ambidextrous. Ehud Ben Gera was a lefty. And the Tanakh tells us the famous story how he killed Eglon Melech Moav because Eglon was watching his right hand and he stabbed him to death with his left hand. From that we learn the lesson, you watch both hands. Ehud Ben Gera was a shofet for 80 years, the longest reign. He lived to be well over 100. And he was the longest reign of all of the shoftim. So the first two shoftim were 120 years. He was from the tribe of Binyamin. Yehuda, see, it did not pass by being the shofet was not genealogical. It did not pass by a dynasty. A man couldn't make his son. None of the sons ever succeeded to their father. None of them. None of the 15. Now, there's an element in the Jewish people, again, part of us is terribly beset by nepotism, and there's a piece of us that just despises nepotism. And the two always go hand in hand, and therefore you always have that problem. It's a problem that's never settled. But none of the shoftim, none of their sons ever succeeded them. So Ehud was from the tribe of Binyamin, not from the tribe of Yehuda. Binyamin was a very populous tribe. Binyamin was a very strong tribe. Binyamin was a favorite tribe. Because Binyamin traditionally was not involved in the disputes of the Jewish people. It was a tribe that was not involved in the sale of Joseph. It was he was the baby brother. Everybody likes the baby brother. That's why baby brothers are such pills. Everybody likes it to be. That's just the way it turned out. And that attachment remained. Until the story of Pelegesh Begiva. The story of Pelegesh Begiva when a terrible atrocity occurred in the tribe of Benjamin and they took no action to rectify the terrible wrong that was done. So then a civil war broke out. And all the tribes of Israel came to war against the tribe of Binyamin. And in the war against the tribe of Binyamin, over 30,000 Jews died in the civil war, Jew against Jew. And not only that, the Jewish people took an oath that they would not allow themselves to intermarry with the tribe of Binyamin. Binyamin was out of the camp. So that literally threatened the extinction of the tribe of Binyamin, the destruction of the tribe of Binyamin. And it was only after a period of time that the vow was lifted. That's one of the reasons why the 15th day of Av is celebrated as a minor holiday is because that's the anniversary of the fact that the ban was lifted and that all the tribes could again marry with one another. So Ehud was from that tribe. So he began his reign in the year 1204. In his last year, when undoubtedly he was already old and feeble and unable, there was the third shofet, whose name was Shamgar ben Anos, and he was a Kohen. He was not from any tribe, he was a Kohen. So you see again the diffusion. And he was the leader for less than a year. He did not last the year until he died. So he was in the 80th year of Ehud, and he himself was the shofet for less than 1 year. But however, he fought a very important battle. He was the first one that stopped the encroachment of the Plishtim from the west. So Ehud stopped the encroachment of Moab and Ammon from the east, and Shamgar stopped the encroachment of the Philistines from the west. But the Jewish people were then demoralized. Imagine, you have 120 years of constant war. We know how we feel in our century. demoralizing generation after generation after generation. Father, son, grandson, great-grandson, great-great-grandson all have to fight the same war over again. No end. No peace. No accomplishment. And one doesn't see the future being any better. And the Beis HaMikdash was not built. The central authority of the government was not established. The Jewish people were rudderless. And the supremacy of the Torah was threatened also, because whether we wish it or not, Torah does not exist in a vacuum. And if there was no security in the country, if there was no, and when there's no security, there's no economy either. It's very hard to maintain Torah. And the fact that the Mishkan and Shiloh was under constant threat of the Philistines, and it was in a bad neighborhood, you know, like many Orthodox synagogues are. So people didn't want to come there. People were afraid to go. People didn't come in droves to celebrate the holidays. We'll see that we come to the story of Shmuel next week. Was very hard to come. So you have a sapping of the Jewish strength. You have a weakness. And the situation is turned around by one great person who happens to be a woman. One of the most remarkable personages in Jewish history. A woman that was a prophetess, and a woman that was a born leader, a woman that had great knowledge and intelligence, and was a charismatic person, and she rose as the savior of the Jewish people, and that's our mother Dvorah, the great prophetess Dvorah. And she was the shofetess, she was the judge for 40 years. And she was the only one that achieved peace. In the first year of her reign, she fought the great war and won it, and then for the next 40 years there was peace. It says in the Tanakh, Vatishko Toretz Arboim Shona. For 40 years she achieved peace. Chazal attribute that to the power of a woman too. It's interesting, the entire thing is interesting, right? That a woman would rise to power in that society and be recognized. And we read her story in the book of Shoftim. She had a meeting place under a date tree, under a palm tree, Tomer Dvorah. And she herself was from the tribe of Naphtali. Her husband was from the tribe of Naphtali. Her husband was a man by the name of Lapidus, who opened the store in Paris and called himself Lapidus, right? We know very little about her husband. Usually if you have a wife like that, so the husband is he doesn't come up for air too often, but she was an enormous personality. And she mobilized Baruch ben Avinoam. Baruch ben Avinoam was also from the tribe of Naphtali. And she became the shofetess in the year 1124 before the Common Era. And she would reign, as I mentioned, for 40 years. Threat from the Plishtim had diminished, the threat from Ammon and Moab had diminished, but now there was one last threat, and that was Yovin Melech Hatzor, the kingdom of Hatzor in the northern Galilee. You go today, it's outside the kibbutz, Ayelet HaShachar is the tell of Hatzor. And the city of Hatzor today, it's a Jewish city. In fact, there are Gerer Chassidim that have built a religious city right there at Hatzor. Hatzor sits on the road that the east-west road through the Galilee. It is a vital city. It was always a fortified city. Shlomo HaMelech will use it as a fortified city. Herod the Great will use it later. The Crusaders would use it. It's of great strategic importance. And Yovin, the king of Canaan, so he developed a new method of mechanized warfare with chariots, just as the Egyptians did. And not only that, he invented new steel, new metals. It was like an advance in technology. He had missiles. He had artillery. And therefore, no one could stand up against him. And there was a place called Charoshes Hagoyim, which is mentioned in Tanakh, which is about 30 kilometers west of Chatzor in the Galilee. Charoshes Hagoyim literally means the factory of the nations, the foundry. There they had foundries, the first foundries to make metal. And they made metal for war. And he had a great general, Sisera. So we had the combination of a great general. Sisera never lost a battle till his last battle. And he had great weaponry. And he had the advantage of new technology. And he terrorized the Jewish people. He terrorized them to such an extent that when Dvorah called for the army to come to fight with Baruch, we see it in the Song of Dvorah. She names all the tribes who didn't come. They didn't show up. They were so frightened. He couldn't mobilize a large army. His army was basically from the tribe of Naphtali, from his own tribe. And the other tribes just stood by and watched, which is, again, as I mentioned to you, indicative of the times of the Shoftim. But Baruch was a skillful general, even though he himself, she told him to go to war, and he said, I can't go without you. You have to come with me. So she gave him the parting shot. She said, I'll go with you, but we're going to win, but the triumph will not be yours. The triumph will be because of a woman. So, she put the zinger into him. And he went up on the mountain of Tabor, Har Tabor, Mount Tabor in the Galilee. It's a perfectly round mountain. It's one of the most beautiful mountains in the world. And it is the mountain, again, that controls the entire road. When you stand on top of Mount Tabor, everything that moves in the Galilee is under your sight and in your control. And he knew that Sisera could not allow that a Jewish army should occupy the mountain of Tabor, because that would be strategically unacceptable. So Sisera came with his army and with his chariots and with his new weapons and his steel. He came with everything to do it. And he made the mistake of all generals who win every battle. After a period of time, one becomes careless. One becomes unchastened. He's just not prepared to lose. He does not protect himself adequately. He allowed Baruch to have the high ground, and he had the low ground. He had his army charge uphill. They were dead tired before they came to the war. And Baruch destroyed them. Baruch charged down the mountain and destroyed them with their chariots, with everything. And Sisera fled, and he fled on foot. And Baruch knew that as long as Sisera was alive, the war was not really won, because of the fact that Sisera was such a tremendous military leader and such a cruel person. Sisera would undoubtedly take revenge. He would come again. It just was a postponement of the war. So he pursued him. Baruch personally pursued him with all that he had. And in the book of Shoftim, Dvorah tells us the famous incident that he came to the tent of Hever Akeni, who had a treaty with Yovin and remained neutral in the war, and therefore he felt safe coming to the tent. And there he meets Hever's wife, Yoel. And Yoel, the rabbis tell us, seduces him. The Gemara calls it Avera Lishmo. Sometimes there's a mitzvah Shalo Lishmo. A person does a good thing and he doesn't mean it. Sometimes a person does something that is wrong, but it's Lishmo, it's L'shem Shemayim, and God not only lets it happen, God counts it as a great event. So she gave him hot milk, and she seduced him, and then when he fell exhausted, she took the peg of the tent with a hammer and put it through his brain. There's a lesson in that somewhere, but it's not the place for it. And she is the woman Minoshim Bo'el Tevoroch. Blessed out of all of the women of the Jewish people is Yoel. Yoel is seen as an heiress to the crown of our mothers, of Sora and Rivka and Rachel and Leah. And then Yovin was crushed. So even though the Jewish people were unable to drive Yovin out of Chatzor, he was no longer a threat to them. His army was completely demolished, his military leader was gone, and that's why it says that for 40 years there was peace. There was peace because Moab and Ammon were controlled on the eastern frontier, the Plishtim were quiet on the western frontier, Yovin, the king of Canaan, was quiet because he had just been demolished. So Vatishko Toretz Arboim Shona. And the famous song of Dvorah, which we use as the Haftorah for Parshas B'Shalach, for Shabbos Shira, that song is the song of exultation. Because that's a song that not just of triumph of war, that's a song of accomplishment, because it accomplished 40 years. Sometimes you win a war, and 2 years later you're back again. It's the same thing. Again, our generation is witness sometimes to the futility of winning the war. Of course, it's always better to win it than to lose it under any circumstances. You should know that. But wars don't settle matters. It's not over. It still has all the problems to it. But Dvorah's war settled something. It brought 40 years of tranquility to the Jewish people. In those 40 years, they rebuilt themselves spiritually as well as physically. It was a golden age. Was the finest time of the Shoftim until the time of Shmuel. So we have covered here the first 160 years of the period of the Shoftim, half of the period of the Shoftim. And we have seen the turmoil of the times, the difficult, difficult times, and the fact that these leaders arose. Now you have to remember that these leaders, it's not only that they arose. God, the Rabboni Shel Olam, sends us leaders as we need them. And he usually sends us what we're entitled to. That's a general statement in politics, that's a comment, that people get the leadership they deserve. There's a great deal of truism to that. But here, these leaders, they fill this terrible void left after the time of Yoshua. Because the period of the Ashoftim is a transitional period. The transition between Moshe and Yoshua on one hand, and Shmuel, Shol, and David on the other hand. And these are the people that filled the void, and through them, the Jewish nation continued, and it grew, and became stronger, even though it had tremendous problems.
This concludes Lecture 99 on Judges 1 by Rabbi Beryl Wein. For information, please contact the Destiny Foundation at 1-800-499-WINE. That's 1-800-499-9346. We can also be reached by email at info@jewishdestiny.com. Shop online at www.rabbiwine.com. Due to copyright laws, we kindly request that there be no duplication of this lecture.